For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Introducing Guy Lawson. He's an author and journalist. He's written for Harper's and many other magazines, and has an article in Rolling Stone from early March, March 4th, The Making of a Narco State. And it's about the drug wars in Mexico. So welcome to the show, Guy.
Yeah, hey, man. Thanks for having me on.
Well, so Narco State, how exactly do you define that? And do you really think that Mexico is can be qualified as such a thing?
Well, look, there's a couple of ways to look at this thing. You know, the conflict, the so-called war, what Calderon calls a war in Mexico. You know, as people live their lives, if, you know, if your listeners have been down to have a holiday on spring break or something, you'll see that it's still a functioning society, and it's far and away. It's as far from Afghanistan in that sense. You know, people can walk the streets at night, and I just took my wife and kids down there for a vacation as well. So in many ways, it's a completely ridiculous statement, but it fundamentally, elementally, politically, legally, criminally, economically, in every kind of metric of a functioning state, it's really becoming the truth. Mexico is in danger of a serious collapse of national security because of the effects of American appetite for narcotics and America's guns and America's hypocritical foreign policy.
Well, the Obama administration already is signaling an increase in money and military equipment, and Admiral Mullen has, I don't know to what degree they've already gone ahead and talked, or at least they've talked about sending troops to the border. It seems like the worse it gets down there, the more the policy is to just do the same, only worse.
They call that the border surge. It's not quite a surge yet, but, you know, hold your breath and it'll become the next surge. They call that Operation Firewall. And if you think about it for a minute, it sounds like a great idea until you consider who's on the other side of the firewall and where the fire is burning. So, you know, that's a very, it's an apt metaphor for the American kind of indifference to the plight of Mexico. Mexico's got murder rates that are doubling, narcotics-related murder rates that are doubling from 2,500 to nearly 7,000, 6,500 last year, and this year it's on course to double again.
And that's out of a population, that's out of a population far smaller than ours, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, but it's just over 100 million. But, you know, more importantly, it's the most dangerous place in the world right now in terms of conflict, more dangerous than Iraq, more dangerous even than Afghanistan. That's the measure of it, you know. So Mexico has still got Cerveza and, you know, all the sort of normalcy, but at the same time there's this violence going on, not just between drug dealers and drug dealers, but between drug dealers and law enforcement and law enforcement and law enforcement and law enforcement and military. It's you've got basically a war between the cartels, a war among the cartels, within the cartels, and then you've got a war with the government waging, the government is waging against the cartels.
Okay, so tell us about some of the cast of characters here. And, you know, in your article, you really go through and tell the story in detail about the head of the national police and the intelligence agencies and the massive amounts of bribes. If the rest of my audience is anywhere near as ignorant as I am about this story, which I assume that they are, no offense to y'all, then they really need to hear this story, something that I really knew nothing about other than, you know, there's widespread corruption, but as far as details, I don't know any of these names, never heard these stories at all.
Yeah, well, let me, perhaps I can just recommend or urge your listeners to go online and look for another story, which I did. The story that you read is actually the second in a series. A story I wrote in Rolling Stone in November was where I went to a state called Sinaloa, which is on the Pacific coast opposite the Baja Peninsula, which is the traditional home of the cartels in Mexico. When Ronald Reagan declared war on drugs, you know, the American rhetoric of war, which is doesn't just apply to conventional conflict, it also applies to drugs, which is a bizarre.
As George Carlin pointed out, it applies to cancer and to everything. It's the only metaphor we have in our society for empowering our government to destroy liberty one way or another.
Yeah, we're just waiting for elections to become war.
Yeah, exactly.
They succeeded to a certain extent through the 80s, to a significant extent actually, from stopping the method of importation of narcotics through Florida and the Caribbean. The Colombians, to a large extent, were thwarted in that way, but it didn't stop the production of narcotics, and it didn't stop the consumption of narcotics. It just meant that a new path into the country was forged, and that was through Mexico. And what the Mexican, the old traditional cartels who'd been running pot up into the United States for decades did was essentially take over the operation of the main operations of narcotics from the Colombians, and became expert at getting all these various cocaine products and now crystal meth and all the other kinds of drugs that you see coming through.
Was this the article where the DEA agents were quoted saying, gee, you know, it's funny, but looking back over the last decade, it's almost like we made things worse.
Well, the Rolling Stone's been covering this this issue. I think that might have been a Ben Wallace Wells article from about a year and a half ago.
That sounds right.
Yeah, my piece was really looking, the first piece that I did that ran in November, I think it was issue 1065 of Rolling Stone, it's online, looked at the tradition, the historical and cultural traditions inside Mexico as it relates to the narcotics industry, and the way that the war amongst the cartels had begun and the impact that it had. I went up into the Sierra Madres, and I went after the modern day equivalent, I guess you'd say, of Pablo Escobar is this guy named Chapo Guzman. Chapo means shorty, and he's been at war with a guy named Machomo. These guys all operate with nicknames, much like in the Wild West, and Machomo means red ant, and they were once allies, but now they've become sworn enemies in this fight to control the various routes in the United States. And again, there's this other group called the Gulf Cartels, which arose basically out of I don't know how complicated it would be for you folks, but I'll just try to give it to you in a nutshell. Basically, NAFTA really, really changed Mexico's culture in almost every way. It changed the political system from a one-party rule. It changed the business rule, and it changed almost everything about the country except law enforcement, which was left behind, and the criminal justice system. And as a part of that sort of the loss of the stability inside Mexican society, you saw all these new drug trafficking cartels emerge, primarily from the Gulf side of the country, which is the other side over in the Caribbean side. And they've been at war with the traditional Pacific cartels, and that was part of the fight that was going on.
Well, you talk about there was some big bust at an airport and some of the top guys of a major cartel were taken down. And then that's really what set off the war between the new guys trying to see who was going to take the place as the new Tony Soprano.
Well, there's put it this way. There's all manner of ways to trace the lineage of this back. But the big thing for your listeners to know is that it really has its roots in NAFTA and the way that NAFTA destroyed this sort of stable, corrupt, but considerably less violent way of running itself that Mexico had. And so now you have these various cartels at war, but the violence was contained. What really transformed this into a huge conflict, the conflict that you see now in your television news and in the newspapers, was the election of 2006, which was the closest election in Mexican history. It was closer even than Bush-Gore in 2000. And that was a hotly contested election. There were protesters in the street in December 2006. The issue of narcotics had not really been a prominent one, not at all, during the campaign between Calderon and his leftist opponent. And it was so bad, in fact, that Calderon had to be smuggled into the parliament, into the Congress, to be sworn into office. And it really seemed like he was not going to hold on to power.
Right. There were thousands of people camped out all through Mexico City around the presidential mansion or whatever for months, right?
And as proof that the rhetoric of war and then the fact of war is initially at least popular way to entrench power, Calderon 5 days later declared war on drugs.
And 5 days later only?
December 6, 2006. And that began this government initiative. 40,000 troops were sent into the streets, and all of a sudden the violence rates went through the roof, and you had the beginnings of what you have now. Now, that's not to say that Calderon did this for purely naked political reasons or that he's not a well-intended man in the sense of meaning what he says. But there is an awful lot of similarity between Calderon's way of solving problems and George Bush's way of solving problems. And there's a lot of similarities between Mexico's war on drugs and the war on terror. It's the all-consuming, must-be-changed, you know, must-be-fought into the bitter death kind of rhetoric where you have people divided into enemies of the state and those who are for, you're either for or against Calderon. It's become a very dialectical kind of political discourse in Mexico. So that is when you can really trace the beginning of the quote-unquote war.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to be too cynical, but is it possible that he knows that a war on drugs is good for driving up the price and making people rich?
No,
I mean,
in the
article you say that the corruption is throughout the entire government, the very highest levels.
No, that way craziness lies. No, that ain't it. Calderon's not in, you know, there's no one who thinks Calderon's in league with the drug dealers, but... If you read the article, my second article, you'll see that almost everyone around him is, or at least is suspected to be. you know, the cartels use law and government as a method to control their own success and their own business model, but also to defeat and destroy their rivals. And so you've seen in the past number of months, the Mexican drug czar, for example, the head of the top secret agency that's in charge of prosecuting and investigating narco cartels, were both proven to be on the payroll of the cartels. This is the equivalent is the head of Homeland Security, the head of the FBI, the head, the drugs are all being, you know, on the take from the Crips or the Bloods, you know? It's really, really disastrous for Mexico, and it's turned the Mexican elite into a very paranoid group indeed. There's kidnapping and extortion have become commonplace as the cartels fight over diminishing revenues because they're fighting so much over these revenues. You have a situation where the elements of national power are being challenged in fundamental ways, and that's really where the narco state thing comes in. It's not a conceit. It's a real distinct possibility for that country.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I know that you're a reporter and you're dealing with the facts of, you know, on the ground here, but is it possible to question the economics of the situation and why it is this way? It seems like, you know, when I was a child, I learned about prohibition and how it just turned the alcohol industry over to criminals. It didn't destroy the alcohol industry, and that it was the bootleggers and the Baptists that teamed up together to try to defeat the repeal of the 18th Amendment.
I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that the impact is, you know, sparking a blunt, you know, the harmless, you know, spliff on a Friday night has inside Mexican society. Marijuana, to speak specifically about the prohibition, represents, they think, something between 60% and 70% of the revenues of the drug cartel. It is the cash cow. It's the thing that funds all their ventures into other drugs and into, you know, establishing their drug trafficking networks throughout the United States. So the prohibition, just for an example, but with marijuana, could have a massively detrimental effect for the cartels. You know, look at what's happening with General Motors when sales are down by 30% and 40%. Imagine if 60% of the revenues to these multi-billion dollar corporations were removed. But having said that, that is, you know, that may be the solution. I think it is the only solution down the road. I mean, the choices that this society faces, which is to say North America, because America and Mexico are entwined in this problem. The border is meaningless in any true way when it comes to the drug traffickers. It's become as porous as can be. There's three choices, really. You can continue to confront the drug cartels and, you know, have the rhetoric of trying to go after consumption the way Hillary Clinton did recently when she was in Mexico, or President Obama has, which is just pie in the sky nonsense. As if people are, you know, that's what I would urge your listeners to think about, the responsibility they have as they buy these drugs. The second choice is to just go back to corruption, to pretend to enforce the law, but just return to the old ways before NAFTA and just basically give up on trying to fight the cartels. Most people in Mexico actually long for those days. They've become nostalgic because it was so much less violent, and it was so much more stable. People, you know, you knew which end was up. If the drug dealers were going to kill someone, they did it on the edge of town at night and left the body in a place for the police to find them. Now there's shootouts in broad daylight. You have this kind of decapitations and this culture of narco culture that's really threatening the youth culture inside Mexico. It's really, really bad. And the third choice, of course, is to end prohibition. It worked. Probably most of your listeners know it worked with alcohol in the 30s in Chicago. What your listeners might not know is that it was the end of prohibition that really destroyed the mafia in New York City. I wrote a book about the mob, and I'm friendly with some old mobsters, and I'll tell you that when they legalized gambling, when you had casinos up and down the East Coast, when you had lotteries, when you had all these kinds of legalized gambling, it destroyed the mob because they lost half their money. And they began to fight amongst themselves over the ever-diminishing returns. They started dealing drugs. The whole culture fell apart. So prohibition or decriminalization has this massive hidden effect, which is it just turns the thing into what it is really. It's a health issue and a business issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so what about cocaine, too? I mean, that's I guess the Antichrist or something, and it's far beyond politically correct to say in front of professional people, but hell, they're the ones who do most of the coke anyway, right?
I mean, I'm not quite so. I'm not really. I mean, a lot of crack cocaine has had a terrible effect on inner city United States.
Well, and that's only because the price is so high that the only way to afford cocaine if you're a poor person is to rock it up.
Well, you know, man, I'm about as libertarian as it comes when to people, whatever gets them through the day and night, and I would, you know, I'm not into telling people what to do, but cocaine for me is a bridge too far, or at least so far. My reporting and my experience on the ground in Sinaloa, in Mexico City, and now I'm working on a story inside the United States that relates to how the Mexicans operate in this country, has all pointed to the fact that these are vicious, violent, dangerous people, and you'd be a fool to think it can be wished away, and that the fight is real, but that the rhetoric of war is really not helpful, and if you use a sort of a judo-type analogy, if you just stop fighting the thing that you don't need to fight and fight the thing you do need to fight, that you would find a very different dynamic in Mexico and in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very well put. Of course, I want to state my radical position or whatever, but the fact is what we really need is simply to just think calm and rationally about this like adults rather than having a knee-jerk, you know, there ought to be a law attitude. If we're smart about it, maybe our society won't decide exactly, you know, legalize everything along the lines that I would like to see. And for the same reasons, not because I like to do cocaine, which I've never done in my life, but because of the consequences for the people of Mexico, for example, or our Colombia policy.
Yeah, you don't need to go much further than Mexico to see how devastating this is. You know, hypocrisy has a terrible wage, and it often comes in hidden or oblique ways. You know, when you have a society which bans something that so many people want, and then fetishizes both the desire for it and the illegality of it. I mean, you know, Jim Webb, Senator Webb from Virginia, came out last week and introduced a bill about the prison rates in this country. And this country is suffocating, and it's just criminalizing and jailing whole generations of young people, particularly black people, African Americans, for drug-related offenses that aren't violent. There's no reason to have these people in jail, and there's no reason to spend $100,000 or whatever it is a year jailing these people. It's a consequence of hypocrisy. And, you know, to all those within the listening of range of this, you know, really think about your own habits, your own, the way that you don't think, you know, you don't confront the consequences of your own consumption.
Mm. Well, there are plenty of drug users in Chaos Radio's audience. In fact, there's, 20 or something at least percent of the population of this country use illegal drugs. So any radio audience is full of drug users.
There you go. You know, it's just that's the way it is. And you know, 60% of Americans are opposed to any kind of legalization for marijuana. Now, I happen to believe that you're seeing the beginnings of a serious debate. Mm-hmm. You know, the president laughed about it at a press conference last week. It was, I think, an uncharacteristically glib way for him to talk about a very profound issue. And I hope that he can dial that back, because this is not just like, you know, Cheech and Chong or some, you know,
right,
on the way to White Castle kind of thing. This is like real people's lives. These are children. You know, here's something like for your listeners to consider. You hear about this corruption and you think, oh God, you know, how terrible, but you know, these people are just so nasty, I guess. But I think certainly a significant piece of the corruption that's inside Mexican law enforcement is because the police and the lawyers and the judges attached are terrified. These cartels are so violent, they will send you they call it the suitcase. They'll give you a suitcase filled with money, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in that suitcase will be a photo of your family. And they have a saying in Mexico, you can take the lead or the silver.
Hmm.
And so these people are on the take in many cases, because if they don't take, and I met people like this, if they don't take, their families will be killed.
Do you have any idea what the official numbers are of the amount of money per year in billions of dollars that we're talking about in the Mexico-America drug market?
Well, you know the joke about where the police buy their drugs, because they're always putting numbers on it that no one would pay, right?
You're right.
You know, the big bust. I don't know where you got your coke, dude, but you're paying too much. You know, in the multiple billions, somewhere between 10 and 30 billion, it's the second largest industry in Mexico, people think, after oil, something along the lines of the tourist industry. It is epic amounts of money. Epic amounts of cash. Chapo Guzman was just put on Fortune 500's list of the wealthiest men.
Right.
He is a billionaire, and I make the joke that he's the only one who's got his $1 billion in cash.
Yeah, well, that's not the same guy that's hidden out somewhere that did the fantastic jailbreak. What's that
that's
about?
That's him. That's Chapo. That's Shorty.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Tell us about that. How did he break out of jail?
They call it the Golden Kilogram. Nobody knows. You know, he was in the maximum security prison. He, you know, to give you a taste for how good Chapo is at what he does, he had a girlfriend in there. He had a couple of girlfriends. You know, as much Buchanan's whiskey as he could drink. He was living at large, even in prison. But
so he walked out the front door, basically.
Well, yeah, and the short answer is in Mexico, everyone he thinks he bribed himself out, but lots of people in Mexico think that the government of Vicente Fox let him out or someone high in that government in order to fight these very violent Gulf cartel, the new drug dealers who have employed this group called the Zetas, which is a Mexican army term for a high-ranking army official. And they are former special services, American-trained special services forces that have become their own drug-dealing cartel, and they are the really dangerous dudes.
Well, and where does all this money go? Because you have to have the money laundered somehow in some form of legitimacy at some point, no?
You do. That's a good question. I don't have the answer for you. People are studying it. It goes into banks. It goes into, you know, buying nice big houses, and then lots of people talk about hotels up and down the Pacific Coast being funded this way, and it's become, you know, the lifeblood of a large section of the Mexican economy, and that's why people are so, you know, the one thing that I, when I was in Sinaloa, that everybody seemed to agree about is that legalization would be a disaster for Sinaloa.
Yeah, well, and I've actually met drug dealers before who said, oh, no, if they legalized drugs, I'd be out of business, just simple as that.
Well,
you know?
stands to reason, man.
Yeah. Okay, so now, who is Vasconcelos, the Bush administration's man in Mexico? What's the story with that?
The guy who was shot out of the sky?
Well, I'm not sure. He got a very brief mention in the Rolling Stone.
He was a national security advisor to President Calderon, and, you know, considered a very untouchable figure. And there was a plane crash in Mexico in early December of last year that killed him and another senior official. I think the other senior official was, in any event, it killed these two very, very senior officials, and lots of people thought at the time that it was the drug cartels had killed them, or that the military had killed them, or the police, or, you know, it was all these conspiracy theories, because there's so much corruption, people really don't know which way to turn or which ends up. But after his death, there's been accusations that he was corrupt himself. You know, as anyone in the know will tell you, Mexico, it's really kind of obnoxious or tragic or whatever it is, because he has no ability to defend himself now, and these charges are so commonplace, and so they're used, the people accuse people of being in the pay of narco as a way to disempower them, to defang them, to destroy them, even if they aren't, or even if they aren't on the pay. So it's become a hall of mirrors. It's a very complicated and fast-moving situation in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the article, you talk about a guy who walked into the embassy in Washington, D.C., and turned himself in as a double agent, and then people now have conspiracy theories about maybe he was a triple agent sent to sow confusion. Tell us about that story.
Well, Felipe is his code name. He was working in the American embassy in Mexico as a liaison between the American and Mexican law enforcement officials, and exactly how he walked into the Washington embassy remains a little bit unclear, which is to say classified. But it would seem that he got caught somehow, but he was one step ahead of somebody. But he basically revealed that he revealed high-level corruption. And then when those people were caught and the various officials and things, they revealed even further corruption. The way these investigations often go is it goes from one person, then they talk to save themselves, and on and on. Felipe, you would have to say, is something on the order of a Watergate of Mexico. It is a revelation. His revelations that have cascaded through the law enforcement and political and security apparatus have revealed the depth and extent of Mexico's problems. So even if you legalize and even if you, you know, recognize that sending more guns to Mexico is just not a good idea, that you have to also recognize, I think, that Mexico's problems are serious, ongoing, and need to be confronted in a very sophisticated and determined way. You can disagree with Calderon in a million ways, and I do, most especially about the idea that this is a war rather than a cultural, health, and social issue. But the one thing that they definitely have in Mexico is a major criminal matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be interested to know what you think about this. It seems like part of the story is now new calls for legislation about guns and gun sales in the United States because of all the arming, arms being sent back and forth across the border, sold back and forth across the border. And, this, I guess, just like I'm a non-cocaine user who's for legalizing cocaine, I'm not a gun owner, but I'm for the right to bear arms. And it seems like here's a problem our government's created, and now their solution is to take away even more liberty when, you know, again, if you don't have the cartels fighting over the thing, it doesn't matter whether guns are for sale in New Mexico.
Yeah, I'm not an American citizen, but this thing really mystifies me, the whole gun fixation. I have to say, the idea that I don't want to take anyone's freedom to have a gun, but just look what it's doing inside Mexico. You know, it's just something has to be done. Now, I don't know, but something. And
But go back to this very same thing. If you outlaw 50 caliber machine guns, then you take them out of the plain old market and you put it into the black market. You turn the whole market of those kinds of guns over to the very same kinds of criminals. Whereas at least now it's half legitimate.
Hey man, I'm just trying to. I'm just. You know,
I'm sorry, you're a reporter, and I'm browbeating you. It's okay.
That's cool. I don't mind.
It seems to me like it's time for people to start, looking at the step-by-step nature of some of the causes and consequences instead of just assuming conclusions and solutions so quickly. That's kind of how we got into this mess in the first place. Nobody likes crack cocaine, and so we fill our prisons with crack cocaine users. We didn't stop and think about how it was we got that way. And so now, as you're saying, it's an emergency. It's a terrible crisis.
It is, man. It is.
Is there a reason you think that the American media doesn't ever really tell the story? Like the Felipe thing. You say it's the Mexican Watergate, and yet I've never heard of that.
Yeah. I think that there's a couple of reasons. I think that, begin with the fact that Americans are complacent and or indifferent to Mexico, by and large. So Mexican stories like Canadian stories just don't get the coverage or taken seriously in the same way. You've got serious problems with the funding and the financing of ongoing investigative journalism. That's why I'm so grateful to Rolling Stone for giving me this opportunity to not just write one piece, but two and now three long-form articles. So those things are becoming rarer as time goes by. It's also a dangerous story. It's also, for Mexican journalists, the most dangerous assignment imaginable. I think Mexico has become the second most dangerous assignment in the world after Iraq for journalists. And most of those suffering from the violence are Mexican journalists because the cartels, just up and kill people. This is a real problem in Juarez where you're getting local newspaper reporters are quitting just because they can't endanger their lives and the lives of their families. So there's that. I think that there's been a kind of a late awakening. I know that the CNN's been doing some reports from there. The New York Times has had some front page stories on it. But, it's part of a larger narrative, which is how well does America report on and care about the impact that its, Goliath-like size and economic power have on its neighbors? And the real answer is that the kind of self-searching and self-critical reporters that I think this country so desperately needs is all too rare.
All right, well, Rachel Maddow, call your office. We got one for you. Guy Lawson, Rolling Stone Magazine. Thank you very much for your time on the show today. Again, pardon me, the article is called The Making of a Narco State.